If your life is going smoothly this week, I'll be surprised. Had a smooth beginning to your year. How about the nature of life today? I'm just guessing here, but I suspect I haven't gotten a yes from you yet. Smooth is an expected ideal, much more than a reality experience with any frequency. Many years ago, when I was a young minister, I ran into a middle-aged pastor in a meeting of pastors. We called it a presbytery. He stood out in the crowd. To me, he seemed cool. His dress was elegantly casual, his hair combed handsomely without perfection or gel. His smile was quick, and good humor seemed to follow his conversations. Ready with my newfound theological precision, I approached the man, along with a few like-minded friends, to check him out further. It really was not too unlike dogs in a dog park sniffing out another breed. He greeted us with that twinkle in his eye of one who knew what was coming, and he was up for the task. It didn't take long for the kidding to begin as he played with our minds, allowing me to call attention to the small, smooth stone he wore on a chain around his neck, knowing I was giving him the very obvious opening that such an adornment desired. I don't remember the story, but I do remember the conversation which followed it. It was about how sin played into preaching. Did he tell people they were sinners in need of a Savior, or did he soft pedal that part of the gospel message? "Let me tell you about the people who come to my church," he said. "All week long, they are told they are not good enough. They don't sell enough. They don't work fast enough. They aren't charming enough or energetic enough, caring enough, and they don't produce enough for the bottom line. Now," he continued, "how am I supposed to tell them they aren't good enough, righteous enough, holy enough, spiritual enough, or godly enough, and expect them to believe we offer anything different from the world?" He made his point. Today, we have someone who knows a few things about rough roads, ruts, and pit holes. He paves them for a living, along with his over 270 employees. Meet Darren Young for our show on Filling in the Ruts. Welcome, Darren, to Church Earth And.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Darren, I described you as a guy who fills in the ruts. Would you like to give me a more sophisticated description of your company, Dryco? What do you guys do?
We are a pavement maintenance company and a construction company. We have a concrete division, an asphalt division. We also have a fence and iron division, and we cover work in the Bay Area as well as Central Valley. And we've grown it to be one of the better companies in the Bay Area, and it's been fun.
Now, I know you don't like to brag, Darren. You're a humble man, but 2020 is going to be remembered for a lot of things. But for you, there's some good things that happened to your company last year. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I it's hard to understand how this has happened, but in this pandemic year, we've had the best year that we've ever had. And our sales, we just got our numbers finished, and it's almost $81 million of business, which is $10 million more than we did last year, which was our best year ever. And so it's hard to explain, but I know that a lot of it has to do with the customers that are here in the Bay Area. You know, the Teslas, the Apples, you know, Amazon, these companies are still going gangbusters. And we're able to meet, you know, tough schedules with the manpower that we have. And that's really the main secret, is being able to meet their schedule. And we've been able to do that. And that's why we had such a good year last year, and we're looking forward to another good year this year.
Now, Tesla, we're in California, used to hearing about the fact that they've made decisions to move to Texas or all that. But you, in the meantime, were paving their park. What was it like paving the parking lot for Tesla?
Oh, Tesla is complete chaos. So they have this huge facility in Fremont, which is like a mile or 2 miles from my office. And it is literally chaos in all ways. They will call you on Monday and say, "I need the bid by Wednesday," and the job starts on Friday, and it's a big job. And not a lot of people are able to meet those schedules. And most of the time we are, which is, like I said, that's what's really been the secret to this year, is being able to meet super aggressive schedules. Amazon's another one. They're building warehouses where they have their little vans coming through 24 hours a day and three shifts. And they want that facility built within 2 months, and it's a 5 month job. And so that's really been our fortune, right?
So people obviously are sitting there going, what in the world are they doing on Church Hurts? And why are they talking about paving of all things? I mean, that's just a dirty job, $80 million or not. I mean, you're really in the ruts and the mess, and you didn't start out as the big executive. And I've was reminded earlier when we talked, you know, it seemed almost every one of our guests who's a man will somehow bring up his father. And so as I talk to you, you know, well, yeah, who's your hero? You know, Darren, it has to do with your dad. But, you know, tell me a little bit about what happened to you at 16, because it doesn't start out with your dad at a real high place in his life, does it?
No, well, you know, I had a great childhood, grew up in a, you know, neighborhood and suburb, and, you know, it was very good. And then when I was 16, just about to graduate high school, my dad went bankrupt. And so we lost everything, you know, the house, the cars. My mom went from driving a Continental Mark IV to a Corvair station wagon that leaked about 2 gallons of oil a day. And, you know, she went to live with her dad, and I went to live with my dad in an apartment in Fremont. And it was just a game changer. It was just a complete game changer.
Well, talk about hitting a rut in life whenever you have bankruptcy going through it. But I'm picturing at 16, that's really in an age where you're still not that much aware of, you know, parents bringing home income and what it means. And then all of a sudden you had to, right? You got to work pretty quickly, didn't you?
Yeah, I had to. My brother, on the other hand, was fortunate that he got to go to Cal Berkeley on academic scholarships. He was a valedictorian, super smart guy. He got all the brains and I got all the looks, is what happened in our family. But
that's been said before, I suspect.
Yeah. So he went off to college, which was good for him. And I was kind of stuck with my dad in Fremont. And of course, my dad wasn't really around much, so I was kind of on my own. I wasn't kind of on my own. I was on my own. Learned how to work and had the drive and the ambition, and, you know, I did okay.
You know, in the board game Life, if you ever played that, there's an alternative to go to school, and that really delays being able to make money in that game. But anyone who's played it much realizes probably the option you ought to go, because there's rewards for the rest of the time. And so your brother got to go that route. You didn't. And somehow what I've experienced is I've just gotten to somehow in my life to know the guys who didn't end up being able to go the school route and be ridiculously successful. But somehow they keep being reminded that they did, that you're insecure, that they didn't go to school. I don't get that from you. You're too busy to be insecure about that, aren't you?
Yeah, I never liked school anyway. So I think it was kind of a blessing that I didn't have to go to school. I kind of learned it the hard way.
You had a Christian background. At least you went to Catholic church. You learned catechism and that kind of thing, but spirituality wasn't a real important thing in your family through any of this, was it?
No. My dad didn't believe for most of his life. My mom was a, you know, devout Christian, but, you know, she didn't appeal to anybody because of her tact. You know, the way she went about it was, you know, beat you over the head with it.
All right. So here, your dad's bankrupt. You end up taking over the business, learning. He kind of taught you the trade though, right? You were out doing driveways around the area, right?
Yeah. So what happened was I went to work for a spice factory and I didn't enjoy what I was doing because they had me on swing shift. And I was complaining at a family dinner, I'm sure. And he said, Darren, you should come to work for me, because now by this time he had gone back into business. That's what guys like him do. They go out of business and they go back into business. And he had a really good account with U-Haul and he was doing well. And so I said, okay, yeah, I'll come to work for you. Sounded great. He'll teach me, you know, construction. And I literally, you know, started as a laborer learning how to shovel. And everything was great for a couple of years. And then in 1982, when interest rates went to 16%, U-Haul decided to stop all construction. And so we found ourselves back in Redwood City with no work. And before he had gone into business for himself, he had worked for a guy in Redwood City that did driveways. And Redwood City is very close to very affluent neighborhoods like Atherton and Portola Valley and Woodside. These are huge houses with huge driveways and tennis courts. And that's what we did, right? We did driveways and tennis courts, but it was pretty hard. You know, we were in a big recession and it was pretty hard to sell work and I didn't know what the heck I was doing. And so he hit the skids again. And at some point he came to me and said, look, I'm not going to be able to get out of this. The IRS has got me tied up. So why don't you go get your license? And I'll come to work for you and teach you the business. You can buy my equipment. I'll write a note for, I think it was $50,000 to buy all of his equipment, which was, you know, it was all junk at that point. Nothing to be proud of. But didn't really have a choice, right? I mean, we were kind of stuck. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, you could go back to work at the spice plant, but what's your dad going to do? And, you know, my mom and dad, they separated, they divorced, but they always stayed together somehow. So he was taking care of her as well. And so I kind of felt boxed in at that point. And I did what I had to do. And again, going to get your contractor's license, you know, that's going to school. I've never been much of a school guy, but, and that was hard for me, but I did it. I got my A license and he taught me the business.
He taught you the business. And we talk a lot about recovery around here. Were there any substance issues involved like there often is in these stories?
Oh, my dad, sure. My dad was I'd like to say he was a functioning alcoholic, but sometimes he wasn't a functioning, most of the time he was. Yeah, it was a struggle. His alcoholism is what caused him all of his problems, basically. That was his downfall, was he would spend too much time at the bar with his buddies and not enough time watching his business. And, you know, I watched it from the sidelines and I couldn't understand it. You know, I'm just like, well, why are you doing this? And I didn't understand, you know, addiction at that point as well as I do now. And, so yeah, it was one of those things. He was great until noon. He'd come into the office early and, you know, we'd work on stuff, bids. He's teaching me how to cost jobs and how to bid jobs. And at, you know, around 11:30, he'd say, well, I'm going to go get a sandwich. I'll be back. And he'd head to Harry's Hofbräu in Redwood City. And that was it. He would not come back. He would be sitting at that bar from 12 o'clock until 7 o'clock that night, rolling dice and, you know, hanging out with his buddies. All of his contractor buddies were the same, you know, had the same MO. And, I was kind of on my own to figure it out, you know, every afternoon. And then I'd stock up my questions. And when he came in the morning, I'd, you know, get as much as I could out of him. And, you know, there were some tough times. There's some disappointment. You call them ruts. Yeah, we had some ruts. But, you know, my dad's the hero of all my stories. And I loved him a lot. And he loved me a lot. And that was what kept things together, right, for us.
We have a lot in common that way. People know my story. You know, they want to say you're giving your dad a break because, you know, my dad was a drunk. But he too went to work and he'd go to a different kind of bar than your dad did. You know, they had fancier names and they'd talk insurance and the other person would get drunk and they'd call their secretaries and say, oh, switch the insurance from this category to that category. But it was still the same story. It was still drunk every day after lunch. And it's hard. But we don't have time to get into the details, but the bottom line, you were a quick study. You saw those nice houses and you said, I think I want one of those. And your business started to succeed while he was he wasn't being very helpful, but you were started multiplying your business, didn't you?
Yeah. It's amazing. It was easy to have success, and all you had to do is return phone calls and, you know, do the right thing when construction, right? When you make a mistake, just fix it, right? Oh, show up. You know, how many people have had experiences with contractors where they say they're going to be there and then they don't show up? So by doing all the right things, and again, at these very nice houses, and of course, you know, I'm having to listen to motivational speakers and read all those books to keep myself, you know, positive and learn sales and techniques. And Zig Ziglar was one of my mentors. And he basically said, you know, you can get everything in life you want if you just help enough other people get what they want. And I looked at those people that own those big houses and I thought, well, I'm going to help them get what they want, which is a nice driveway. And in the process, I'm looking at these nice houses saying, well, I would like one of those. And he said, well, you know, if you write down your goals and you write them down big and you read them every day and you keep focused on them, you're going to get whatever you want. And so I was kind of naive and wrote down, the big house on the hill with the big driveway. I mean, I knew exactly what it was, and just kept working hard and ended up there.
Well, let's just jump to 25. You've already had some significant success. You're basically a workaholic, though. You're going 7 days a week. You're running and gunning, and we haven't talked about your bride at all, who I really got to know before I got to know you. And she put her foot down one day, didn't she? She said, this has got to change. I'm not willing to kind of be the work widow.
Yeah. She, at one point she said, okay, buddy, you know, we have two kids now at this point. And she's like, you can't work 7 days a week. I need you home on Sundays to spend time with the family. And I said, great. Cause I was tired. You know, I'm like, okay. I was kind of glad she put her foot down there. And then another time, she was working full time too, and raising the two kids and doing the housework and all the chores. And I'd work hard. I'd get home late. I'm tired. I'd sit on the couch, turn on the TV, you know, have a beer. And one night she came out and said, hey buddy, guess what? You know, I'm doing this. She named off all the things she was doing, and she was right. Not only that, she'd mow the lawn on the weekends because I was working, right? And she said, look, you just need to pick a chore, right? Just pick a chore. I'm like, pick one chore? And she's like, yeah, just pick one chore. And I'm like, okay, well, I'll pick cooking because I think I can do that better than you anyway. And she's like, that's fine. I go, so I don't have to do laundry? Nope. I don't have to do dishes? Nope. You just make the dinner for the family every night. And that's good. That's good enough. And I guess what? Family dinner was last night and I cooked dinner for the whole family, grandkids, everybody, because that's my job. That's what I do.
You know, that story is almost identical to mine. I did the same thing, but I was a bit dimmer. It took me 4 years. I took the responsibility for dinner, but really it kind of meant, well, unless I had a good excuse, and then it was still stuck on my wife. It took me 4 years to figure out, no, doing dinner really meant dinner. And, but now what a joy. We can talk about cooking all day, and you're a good cook too. I mean, I had the same thing. I said, I like to cook. She didn't. So I thought my food was better. And, but what kind of, how to turn something into fun, huh? That is fun for you now.
Yeah. It's a great way to unwind for me to come home from work and just, you know, prep and cook. And yeah. And you know, one of my love languages is, you know, serving others. So it's an opportunity for me to, you know, give her a nice dinner. And, you know, I wish the kids would have appreciated it growing up, but you know, I had this thing I used to say, you know, I said, you know, you don't have to like it. You just have to eat it.
Oh, I've turned my son into the biggest food snob in the world. He at the age of 12, I think, asked for steamers for his birthday party. I thought, oh, I'm in trouble. Yeah. Something else happened though. When it came to church for the first time in your life, you really decided, okay, you're going to go to church. And you dove in. Like everything, you dove in head first. And it was all just perfect, wonderful experience. And life's been good ever since, right?
Well, you know, the diving in part was good. I'll definitely tell you that. But yeah, there's been some ruts. There's been some ruts in my spiritual church life, and church hurts and seems an appropriate place to talk about it.
So I mean, I see the story as this. Here you go. You're the pastor's dream. Here he gets this driven businessman who's really never been involved in church, that's buying it hook, line, and sinker, has a personal relationship with Jesus, comes in the door and doesn't just say, okay, I'm going to help the offering plate a little bit. You know, a big businessman, that's always nice. You got on the worship team, you know how to sing, you're there setting up chairs. This is a startup church that's experiencing success. And how did it feel to you? Because you'd never been part of anything like that before.
You know, it was exciting. It felt really good. And the thing that was most fun for me was the people that I met, you know, a bunch of people that thought like me and felt like me. And we, you know, when we joined this church, we had this awesome pastor that was energetic, and he would do his sermon, and I'd be like, does this guy have my phone tapped? I mean, he would be speaking to me, and I was just eating it up. I was loving it. Everything applied. Everything started to make sense in my life, because, you know, up until that time, I knew God was there, but I didn't know, you know, who God was and how he worked. We had a small group that we put together from that church. It was a crazy God thing, because we went through, you know, all of us in that group, there was 12 of us, all of us hit some really strange ruts that together we kept each other together. I mean, some really, really crazy stuff happened. And we look back at it, the small group's not together anymore. We look back at it and we go, wow, what a God thing that was, for us to all have gone through what we went through and all be together. I mean, we're still all close friends, but we're not the small group that we had. So that was interesting. It was interesting to see it all come together.
In a real short, I mean, just cutting through a lot of pain and a lot of struggles. There's not the same name of the church on the front door anymore. They kind of merged with other ones. You saw the pastor go through stuff that was heartbreaking for you, because you knew the inside scoop, right?
Yeah.
And how many years, I mean, you worked day in and day out, and with, I mean, the best motivations in the world at that church, and just never really had the leadership to take off, did you?
No, like I said, the guy that started the church when I joined, he was there, and he was the guy, right? He could get right into your soul and preach to you in a way that, you know, is fulfilling, right? Is life changing. But he ended up divorcing his wife, and so the leadership decided he had to go. He could no longer be the pastor, which at the time, I was so new to the church, I didn't understand that. I'm like, well, that's crazy. Everybody gets divorced. My parents got divorced. I know everybody gets divorced. Why couldn't he stay to be the pastor, right? Well, he couldn't. And the reality is, we never really found a replacement that could grow the church as much as we tried. At one point, we lost our building because they were going to tear it down and build houses. And our pastor said, well, that's it. We're done. And we got together. We, like the leaders of the church, and a lot of the guys were in construction. A lot of them I brought in. And we had we had capabilities that other people didn't have, other churches didn't have. So that's where we met you, right? We did the campaign to raise the funds, raised more money than I ever thought was possible, bought a building, rebuilt it. And that was kind of high point was that time in my life. We were just on fire. But again, that pastor wasn't able to take full advantage of it, and just wasn't, you know, people were just leaving. Instead of people coming, people were leaving, and you watched the congregation shrink, and then you know, you get another pastor and he's not able to do it, and it keeps shrinking. And eventually it gets to the point where you get there and you look around and it's so depressing because you just go, where did everybody go? Right. Where?
Oh, isn't that the hardest thing in the world? Oh, to watch the church decline. Oh, I mean, talk about pain, and hence our title, obviously, Church Hurts. Before I get to the end, one time you were out at the grill and your wife came out and asked you where your two-year-old, had you seen your two-year-old? Tell me about that, will you?
Yeah, Christmas Day. And I wasn't at my grill. I was building my grill. So I'd gotten a Weber, one of those gas Webers for Christmas. And so me and my dad were out there on the deck in the backyard, and we're putting this thing together. So excited because we're going to cook Christmas dinner on it. And she comes walking out of the back door and says, "Where's Hunter?" And I'm like, "I don't know. I'm building this grill." And she just gives me that kind of disgusted look and goes through the garage, because the garage leads to the front yard, and the front yard's where the street is. And we live at the end of a private street, but still, you know, you don't want two-year-olds running around out there unsupervised. I got up and turned around, and I don't know why. I looked at the pool, and I couldn't see the pool because there was bushes that are covering it. I could see just part of it, and I could see that there were ripples. And I stood up so I could see the whole pool, and I saw my two-year-old basically floating face down in the deep end, and screamed, "Call 911, and ran over to the edge of the pool. You know, he was wearing one of those onesies, those fuzzy onesies that those guys wore back then. Yep. Pulled him out of the pool. And I don't even know why. I don't know CPR. I never learned CPR, but I pulled him out. I set him, you know, belly down on the side of the pool, and I turned his head and I pushed on his back just kind of gently. And, you know, water came gushing out. I picked him up. Again, he threw up a bunch of water. He was kind of out of it. And at this point, my wife comes running back in, and she's screaming hysterically. And my mother is there, and my mother, I don't know what she said to my wife, but got her to just calm down, and so she took the baby away from me and, you know, held him to his chest, and he slowly came back to, and it didn't take but a couple minutes for the fire department to show up and check him out. He had, you know, hypothermia. So they, you know, they put him in the ambulance and took off my wife's shirt and put him on her bare skin so that, you know, it could warm him up. And, that was my Christmas Day. Everything turned out fine. He had a little bit of water on his lungs, but nothing that needed any, you know, he had the hypothermia was the worst thing, but I remember the fire department would come by every year, and, my wife would make him cookies, right? And they would say, you know, 9 times out of 10, the story doesn't end this way. Nine times out of 10, it's too late. And he's been a few ruts in my life. That's not the only rut with that guy, right? Tell me the short,
because I mean, you love that boy a lot, and he ended up causing you a little more heartbreak. And it's the last story I'm going to be able to let you tell, because our time's almost up. But tell me about that, because that man, that was hard.
Yeah. So he just turned 29. Family dinner last night was about his 29th birthday, and you know, he's one of those ADHD kids with, you know, dyslexia, and he's got some challenges, and getting him through school has always been a challenge. Had to send him away to certain schools because he just couldn't do what he needed to do. And then he struggles with addiction. So we've had, you know, several times where that's been a problem. Currently I've got him talking to a therapist that is helping, because, you know, the holidays come around or his birthday comes around, and that's when he tends to, you know, lose it. Something about holidays, something about birthdays, and addiction, and those seems to put those guys over the edge. And, but you know, knock on wood, today he's okay.
You do more than knock on wood. I asked you about business and what it was like being a Christian in the business world. And you said, in the business world, if you're grounded in Christ, people know it. You're not one of those guys out there with bumper stickers on all your trucks saying Jesus saves. What do you mean by that? People know it.
Well, when you have a faith, right, you understand that it's bigger than you, and it's kind of a relief that it's not all on me. You know, God's in charge of this. And so you have a confidence, and you have a need to do the right thing. You know, it's just amazing how many contractors like me are not driven to do the right thing. They're driven to make money. And, you know, Zig Ziglar was my motivational teacher, and he was a very devout Christian. And, you know, I didn't know it at the time, but later on, as he got older, he started to do more speaking of the gospels and all that stuff. And it all tied together. It all makes sense. And so people know that you're going to do the right thing. And if things go wrong, you're going to take care of it, because things always go wrong. And then my guys, right? My employees, I started at the end of a shovel. I know what it's like to be, you know, people aren't doing, you know, jumps and skips to get into construction. I mean, these millennial kids aren't really looking for a job shoveling asphalt or troweling cement or building fences. And so, you know, it's hard work, and I appreciate what these guys do, and they know that I appreciate them. And they're also, you know, we're 95% Mexicans here, and they're based in Christ as well. They're family oriented men that, you know, have faith, most of them, and they just appreciate working for somebody that really cares about more than making money, right? It's not about making money. It's about making opportunity for the guys that work here. The money will come, right? Yep. You just have to have the right attitude, and it shows. It shows up.
Well, Darren, I wasn't going to say anything about this, but I'm going to say something as we close. Before I do, you know, you saw me in the midst of work after I'd left the pastorate, and then you saw me at my bottom when my life was just caving in, and you didn't give up on me. And that's kind of just, I think, a lot of who you are. But when I asked you to come to this show, you asked me, why me? And went on to express confusion as to what you would have to offer. I was not aware of your record-breaking business in 2020. I didn't know the story about Hunter almost dying at the bottom of the pool. I just knew that Darren is the real McCoy. He lives his faith in the hard times and in the good times. His Facebook page is filled with active pictures of him on skis, water, and snow, visiting beautiful places with a grinning wife or at his side, maybe a new litter of puppies, or on a horseback ride. Darren indeed does a good job at having fun. But Facebook isn't reality, is it? We don't post pictures of the quiet moments in depression as we agonize over the employees who could lose their job if we make a mistake. We rarely hear successful people talk about their doubts and insecurities, failings, and depression. Life is hard, and decisions need to be made often at the most inopportune times. Many people today are experiencing a time that seems very unsettled. The pandemic has been a punch in the gut. Political unrest and controversy have reached new division levels, sparking conflict in families and personal relationships few of us have experienced before. What direction are we to take? What will the future hold? One of the most outstanding leaders in the history of the world was in such a time when he stopped and took stock of the people he led. He summarized all the worldviews which had competed for their allegiance. And then he revealed his decision. And before taking a poll, he famously said, "As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." But what if this happens? Or what if that happens? What about sickness or financial ruin or death or paralysis? Another famous leader said this, "For I'm convinced that neither death nor life nor angels nor principalities nor things present nor things to come nor powers nor height nor depth nor any other created thing will be able to separate us from the love of God which is in Christ Jesus, our Lord. It's worth a thought. Enjoy God today. For Church Earth, and this is John Bash.